Well, we're in a series on the fear of the Lord, and the key thought I want us to take to heart each time is to remember the grand purpose of all, that you were created by God to glorify Him and to enjoy Him forever. And in the context of the biblical meaning of fear, in its rightful place, you were made to fear God with an everlasting delight. We began this series in session one on the fear of God. It was just an introduction to understanding the nature of fear. It's complex. It should not be oversimplified. You might have error on the side of no fear and error on the side of fear. So it's not simply to have or not, and it's not simply on a given attribute of God either. For the second session was the session on the God of fear. So we introduced the fear of God, and then we looked at the God of fear. And we have three sessions on the God of fear. The first one last time dealt with holiness, the holiness of God. This is the apartness, the otherness, the non-creatureliness of God. This distinctive other that causes the creature to simply be overwhelmed. Today, we want to consider, number three, the God of fear in His justice. And here again, allow me to just remind us all and encourage us all to come at this with the mindset that it is not that we look at one attribute of God and say, okay, a non-believer should fear that, but not a believer. A believer should only fear these attributes. That is not how we approach this, because, again, fear is a complex reality, and it can be thrilling, and it is intended to touch the nerve of our very hearts. So in every attribute of God, even the believer ought to have a reverent, respectful, and even delightful fear of God. Nevertheless, some attributes are going to major in fear that can be predominantly in the unbeliever. So tonight, I want to approach the subject before us as the attribute of justice. You might say righteousness, for in the Hebrew and the Greek, they're interchangeable, just and righteous. The idea of looking at God, the God of fear, as a God who is just, who is perfectly just, who is righteous. I want us to look at it in three steps, and each of them I've tried to alliterate to help us remember. Let's just begin with the idea of the absence of fear. Then we'll look at abject fear, which is a wrong fear. And then we'll look at adoring fear as it relates to the justice of God. Let's begin. If you would like to join me, let's go over to Romans and look. We'll begin here and end here, and so it fits nicely. But let's go to Romans chapter 3 and join me to consider the absence of fear as the justice of God brings an important reminder to us in the absence of fear. Romans 3 verse 10. As it is written, none is righteous. So when we think of God as just, we're saying God is righteous. And when we hear none is righteous in comparison to God, in contradistinction to God, none are just. None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. And now, if you would please read this with me in the ESV, verse 18. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And that line punctuates all that precedes it. And so this very important principle of righteousness, justice, as a moral character, is absent when the fear of God is absent in the creature. I'll run down a few examples for you. In Genesis chapter 20, verse 11, Abraham said this, and I quote, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." So Abram lies, and he justifies it because the humans there had no fear of God, and so they would do wicked. When there is no fear of God in the eyes of man, he's a beast. Psalm 36, 1 says this, "Transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes." The idea there is that there's something deep down inside, but it's so deep that he can actually suppress it. It's not on the surface of his conscience because there's no fear of God. So he does not do what's right. His conscience is calloused to righteousness, and that is described as having no fear of God. Now, having no fear of God, the absence of fear is attributed to a number of things in sacred scripture. And one of those things, watch this, is worldly power. A worldly power has a tendency to eclipse a fear of God. So, Exodus 9:29, Moses said to Pharaoh, listen to this, "As soon as I have gone out of the city, I will stretch out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease and there will be no more hail, so that you," watch this, "may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord God." Pharaoh had a kingdom and was the icon of power in the world at that time. And Moses boldly says, "I know that you have no fear of God yet." Even though plagues had already begun, he had no fear of God. So worldly power is one of the reasons behind this no fear, this absence of fear. Well, worldly prosperity is yet another. Worldly power and worldly prosperity. There was a season, in fact, there were several seasons in the history of Israel's life, wherein she prospered and lost the fear of God. One of those instances was during the time of Hosea, a contemporary of Isaiah. And in the north, Hosea said this, "Israel is luxuriant, a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit." In other words, right now, God has blessed you and you are reaping what you did not sow. Watch what he says. "The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built." An altar is an object in service to worship. And in Israel, there was to be only one altar. But the northern tribes set up multiple altars. "As his country improved, he improved his pillars, sanctuaries, places of immoral devotion to God, the Asherith. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. And Hosea 10:3 says this, "For now they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. And a king, what could he do for us?" Now they had a king, but the point and the logic of this statement is that that king they have is worthless. He is as nothing before God. And therefore, this is true. No matter the strength any nation has, they have not strength if they do not fear the Lord. And this is because, again, worldly power eclipses the fear of the Lord. There's an absence of fear. And worldly prosperity. And isn't this a bit concerning to us, living in the most powerful and prosperous nation in the world? It is a nation in which we face dangers we don't even know. Dangers that seduce us away from the fear of God. These are two things that I notice that happen to grip me on the thought of the absence of the fear of God. Now, let's turn to Luke. We'll come back later to Romans, but for now, let's go to Luke chapter 18. I want to tie in this connection to justice once again and remind us of the absence of fear is related to the absence of just and righteousness. John Calvin said it this way, "Without the fear of God, men do not even observe justice and charity among themselves. Without the fear of God, man will pervert morality. He will disregard the morality of God, and he will seek to establish his own perversion of morality. This is the nature of the absence of the fear of God." Look with me, if you would, just at Luke 18, and I find it striking, even though subtle, that Jesus would choose to describe a judge in describing one who had no fear of God. I think there's a subtle irony here that's coursing beneath the parable, because what he is doing in the mind of his listener is he is appealing to the concept that justice must always correspond to the fear of the Lord. Watch what this parable teaches us. Verse 1, this is Luke 18. "And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. His purpose was to teach on persistence." Watch this. Verse 2, he said, "In a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man." You notice that? Neither feared God nor respected man. Verse 3, "And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me justice against my adversary.' For a while he refused." This already tells us he's an unjust judge. She's appealing for justice, and he is corrupt. And why is he corrupt? Because he had no fear of God. Well, it says this, "For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, 'Though I,'" and you see how Jesus goes out of his way to make this point? Here the man, he doesn't have to tell us the bubble thought that the judge had, but he does, so that the reader would catch it. "Though I neither fear God nor respect man," verse 5, "yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice." The lesson to the parable thus far is to show that, number one, the implication is God is just. And therefore, he is to be feared. And this example of a man is just like the father that Jesus tells elsewhere when he says, if you being evil know how to give a good gift to your own son, how much more would your Father in heaven know how to give good gifts to those who ask? And the same is true here. If a corrupt judge who does not fear God, which is the basis of justice, then how much more, if he were to give justice on the basis of persistence, how much more would a perfect judge give justice when repeatedly asked? Let's finish it out just for the honor of the text. He goes on and says, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. And verse 6, and the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. You notice how he just said that explicitly? Unrighteous judge. Literally in the text, an unjust judge. He connected it by earlier introducing him as a judge who did not fear God. Now he's an unjust judge. And he says it this way. He says, hear what the unrighteous judge says. Verse 7, and will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And in a later session, Lord willing, we will come back to that point because there Jesus is describing faith truly in the language of the fear of God. Let's look at one more example for the sake of thinking of the absence of fear. Here, this judge had an absence of the fear of God, and he was therefore not just. Let's look at another reason here that the absence of fear demonstrates its relation to justice. This is Luke chapter 23. So join me at chapter 23, verse 40. The scene is familiar. This is the scene of the three crosses. And let's look, just jump into the middle of their interaction. Verse 40. But the other rebuked him after one derided the Lord, saying, do you not fear God? Now notice the reason he wants to show that this man is corrupt in his thinking and acting. Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation, justice? And we indeed, what? Justly. For we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man, pointing to Jesus, has done nothing wrong. You notice the rebuke here is to say, how can there be an absence of the fear of God in you? For you are experiencing justice. Justice is intended to induce the fear of God in you. This is now my thesis. This is my point. We have just cause for fearing God. There's an absence of fear in the world, an absence of the fear of God. And that's because there's an absence of a right view of God. When there is no high view of God, there will be no fear. When God is casual or impotent, there will be no fear. When God is a God only of love, and has no threatening justice against the moral criminal, the sinner, then there's no fear. But a right fear of God does come from a right view of God. I would ask this last question. What is opposite of the fear of God? Some might say that the opposite of the fear of God is to have no fear. We rehearsed that in session 1. this has been an experiment in our culture that has proven false. There's more fear in our culture today than there ever was when the fear of God was before the eyes of more people. And so it is that what we find is that the opposite of the fear of God is not no fear, but rather the opposite of the fear of God is the fear of lesser things. The fear of lesser things. And beloved and friends, listen, it always then comes down to this dynamic. And it is the dynamic of displacement. Every one of us, every one of you is wired to fear. And you will fear something. And you will fear someone. And God calls your heart to fear Him alone. If you do not fear the Lord, if there is no fear of God, there will be fear. But it will be fear of other things. It's a law of displacement. One example I'd love to show you, if you don't mind, just jump back a couple books with me to one book, in fact, to the book of Mark, and look at chapter 4, a story I love to read over and over, a portrayal of which I have painted in my room. Mark 4:37, and a great windstorm rose, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. But he, that's Jesus, was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they, the disciples, woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now what's striking here, stop for just a moment, is, you see, they're afraid. They are gripped by fear. And the fear that they have is a fear of the powers of nature. And those powers of nature can take their mortal earthly life. And this is their fear. And R.C. Sproul rightly pointed out, as echoing theologians that came before him, Otto in particular, he reminded us that it was Sigmund Freud and other pop psychologists who suggested that religion is a man-made invention to control the masses by fear. And it largely sprung up out of superstition because of the powers of nature. What was rightly pointed out in a passage like this is that if this were true, then the rest of this passage makes no sense. Because you see, the fear that they now have is actually replaced by a greater fear. Look at it with me. Verse 39. And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so," what's the word? "Afraid." He read their fear of the powers of nature. And he said, "Why do you fear those things? Have you still no faith?" Watch this, verse 41. And they didn't answer him. Look at what happens. And they were filled with what? Great fear. In fact, in the Greek, it's mega fear. They had fear of the powers of nature. So they woke Jesus up and said, "Help us, deliver us from the powers of nature." And Jesus looks at them and says, "Why do you fear those lesser powers?" He speaks a word and overpowers creation. And then they were filled, not just with fear, but the displacement of their fear of nature was displaced by a greater fear. Now that doesn't fit Maslow's hierarchy of needs or Sigmund Freud's theory of fear. This speaks of something of a tremendum, a reality that causes trembling, greater than the powers of nature. This is the nature of, you see, Jesus said, you still have no faith. And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? What is my point? My point is simple, that to have faith is to have the fear of the Lord. To have no faith, like Jesus said, where is your faith? You have no faith? Are you still have no faith? This is to have no fear of God in the face of lesser powers. So my point is, when we think of the absence of fear, we ought to think there is just cause for us to fear God. Not only because he is holy, but because he is just. I would declare, not only because he is holy, for that is the creaturely instinct, but because he is just, for that is the instinct of the image of God. Now we advance, we actually increase and progress in the soul of the human being. Any creature, even an animal, can cower out of fear of pain of that which is more powerful than it. But the kind of fear I'm after tonight is for us to appreciate in some measure the apprehension or arrest of the moral nature of God and how that demands that we tremble. The issue that I'm after is to contrast to holiness. We talked about holiness and the otherness and just the sheer majesty of God. Now we want to look at the morality of God. Majesty and morality. And as far as that majesty goes, I remember, one time I was in the ocean on an island in a beach I probably shouldn't have been. No one was there but my beloved. So I had no one around. And there, a storm came in, a tropical storm. And I'm playing around like a fool in the water. And I'm the only one as far as my eyes can see. And the next thing I know, I turn around after I got slammed down. I get up and I look back. And lo and behold, without my anticipation, there was a massive, and I mean massive. Of course, my recall will probably exaggerate the point, but it was a massive wave. It felt as though it stood 50 feet tall before my face. And I remember it was as though time stood still. Everything, all of my senses were shut down. Everything I felt went in slow motion. And my whole soul, literally for a moment, I was elated in this unbelievable experience of fear. And it was the fear of sheer power. There was such a power before me, I had no thought of any form of survival. No recourse, no escape. It was imminent and dominant. All I could do was dive down as far as I could and hold on to the sand, which doesn't work, and allow the wave to go over. My point is, it gave me a taste. I walked away from that, tasting a little bit of the fear of sheer power. This is more than that. This is more gripping and deeper. I'm after the concept of justice. Righteousness, which is the standard of God in all his thoughts and desires. Allow me just to run through a few verses so that I can speed through into some more the other 2 points. Leviticus 19 helps to show us, reveal something of the righteousness of God and the fear that that will induce. Watch this. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. Leviticus 25, 17. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God. 25, 36. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God. 25, 43. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly, but fear your God. Beloved, you see that the theme is, do what is right. Do justice out of a fear of God. Because God is just. 2 Kings 17 says this in verse 34. To this day they do according to the former manner. They do not fear the Lord. They do not follow the statutes or the rules or the law or the commandment that the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. Do you see the connection there that he's describing? He's describing that they're doing according to their former manner. This is speaking of the time when the Assyrians came and there was all sorts of betrayal of the way of the Lord. And the point is, they did not fear God and therefore they did not obey God. This is rife. I can't tell you, you can go on something like YouTube. I hate even mentioning this, but you could go there and you could see, things like dumb criminals and things like this, where you watch this video clip of a surveillance camera that's in a store, a public store, and you see criminals come and they look straight at the camera. And they literally take the item, look at the camera, put it back, look at the camera, take it again, stuff it, and walk away. And you think to yourself, what is happening here? They're looking at the camera. Either they think that there's no one behind the camera watching, or they think that the camera's just a decoy, or they think that whoever is collecting this information simply doesn't care, or they live in California. Never mind, sorry. They're looking at the camera and they literally do their wickedness. And what's my point? There's no fear of God in their eyes. And this translates when there are no cameras. A couple one time came to Rick Holland. I remember him personally telling me this story. A couple came to him that he was counseling, in premarital counseling. And they came one session and they were weeping and crying and they wanted to confess their sin, that they were unfaithful to God and sinned in a grievous way, sexually. And Holland, he just shook his head and he said, I know, I know. And they stopped and they looked at him. What do you mean? And he said, yeah, I know someone else saw you. And they immediately froze. What? Someone else saw us? And he said, yeah, yeah. And they said, who? And he looked at them with tears in his eyes. And he said, God. Now, beloved, listen carefully. They were relieved. When they should have been crushed. You know what that revealed in their hearts? They had a greater fear of man than God. They were more afraid that a sinner would see them sin than that a perfect, righteous, and just judge would see them sin. This is the nature of no fear of God in their eyes. They will do abominable things. Now remember, there are different types of fears. And getting fear wrong can be deadly. I've talked about no fear, the absence of fear, and now I want to move into abject fear. When we think of God as just, I want to move into abject fear, because abject has the idea of being hopeless and miserable and wretched and dismal and servile and gloomy and dark. It is negative. An abject fear is not what I'm after when I speak of the justice of God. Abject fear is not what Christians should have when they think of God as just. So I want to stress this. We have to get fear right. Getting it wrong can be deadly, because getting it wrong can mean, well, everything from legalism to licentiousness. Saying that we don't need to fear God, and so we have a license to sin. To saying that it's all about these outward forms of claimed obedience, and there's no heart and substance and gravitas of God. Some Christians conclude things like this: well, we must fear God, we see it in Scripture, it's commanded, so let's make people afraid of God, like as though making them afraid of God in a manner that in some way is incompatible with loving God. Some would teach and claim this to be Christian, that to fear God in some way has to carve out the idea of loving God. There's an economy, and so we can only have so much love, and then we have to fill in the rest with fear. And these are wrong. Wrong views of understanding fear. I want to stress this. I concluded our last session by saying, sadly, Christians are not immune to sinful fear, which leads to our next session. And here we are, abject fear. Abject fear, a miserable fear that flows from sin. If a Christian fears the justice of God, or God as just, out of their sin, that is a wrong form of fear. Let me further explain. An abject fear, a sinful fear of God as just, is a fear that flows from sin. It's a fear that drives you away from God, not drawing you to God. This kind of fear I mentioned even last time is the fear of guilt, for instance. And if we had time, we would spend that time looking in Genesis and showing the intensity of the fall of man and the very first sin that humanity committed against God. And it literally describes that Adam ran and hid. This he had a fear. He said, "I was afraid of you." The first time fear is mentioned in the Bible. The first time it's mentioned, it's an abject fear, a gloomy, dark, dismal fear, a fear that drove man from God. This is not the kind of fear that we should have when we think of God as just. Not we, Christians. Even the demons have that kind of fear. That is not the kind of fear we ought to have. Because that kind of fear speaks of guilt that leads to punishment. And that's the point. Let me read a few examples of this. Hebrews 10:26. "For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries." You see, this is not what Christians should have. Psalm 119:120 says, "My flesh trembles for fear of you, and I am afraid of your judgments." This is where the law weighs down on the heart and exposes the guilt of a moral being before a perfectly moral judge. Isaiah 59:18 says, "According to their deeds," the unbeliever, now let me just point this out then, the unbeliever has just cause to fear the justice of God. The unbeliever ought to have a terrifying fear of God because he is just. Not just powerful, but he is just. And so Isaiah 59 would remind us, according to their deeds, so will he repay wrath to his adversaries, repayment to his enemies. To the coastlands he will render repayment. So they shall fear the name of the Lord from the west and his glory from the rising of the sun. For he will come like a rushing stream which the wind of the Lord drives. You see, the key here is that there is reason that people should have fear of God in their eyes. If they're sinners, they ought to fear his wrath because he's just. As we think about this now, we're thinking in those terms right now, in contrast to the absence of fear. We want to see even an abject fear, one that we don't want to have as Christians, but one that is clearly necessary, a fear for the sinner ought to have a fear of judgment. Jesus himself will say in Luke chapter 21, there will be, speaking in the future judgment to come, there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and the earth distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and the foreboding of what is coming on the world. You see, Christ himself says that fear, right now, men and women who have no fear of God, there's coming a day where they will all have a fear of God. From east to west, they will fear God. This is his point. In Revelation 6:16, that fear of God comes from the wrath of the Lamb, justice of God coming upon the unjust, the righteous Savior coming against even the sinner. In Revelation 6:16, calling to the mountains and rocks will be some of these. Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? Revelation 14:7 says, and he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. You see, the fear of God is not preached anymore, and the justice of God is not rightly preached much anymore. This principle, I fear God and I fear for those who do not. And this is what compels me even to share this with you tonight. The reality is we need to be sobered by the fear of God in his just wrath. One example, in Luke 12, verse 4, Jesus says, I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body and after that have nothing more that they can do, but I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has the authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Charles Spurgeon says this well. You and I can never imagine all the depths of hell. Shout out from us by a black veil of darkness, shut up from out from us by a black veil of darkness. We cannot tell the horrors of that dismal dungeon of lost souls. Happily, the wailings of the damned have never startled us. For a thousand tempests were but a maiden's whisper compared with one wail of a damned spirit. It is not possible for us to see the tortures of those souls who dwell eternally with an anguish that knows no alleviation. These eyes would become sightless balls of darkness if they permitted for an instant to look into that ghastly shrine of torment. Hell is horrible. For we may say of it, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither hath it entered into the heart of man to conceive the horrors which God hath prepared for them that hate him. We don't preach like that anymore. We lack the fear of God in this way. There is a place still in the church, even among those who are children of grace, to be reminded that God is a just God and the wrath of God is to be feared. Archibald Alexander said this just phenomenal. I must read at least excerpts. Impenitent men are apt to harden themselves against the awful denunciations of divine wrath contained in the Bible and to cherish unkind feelings toward the ministers who bring out plainly and authoritatively the doctrine of the New Testament on the subject. And it cannot be denied that some preachers denounce the terrors of the New Testament against transgressors in a style and manner adapted rather to irritate than to convince. They speak almost as if they took pleasure in these awful threatenings and as if they had nothing to fear for themselves. No doubt many a zealous preacher has passed sentence on himself and has actually suffered those torments which he denounced against others. I am therefore disposed to present this subject in a light which cannot give offense. Instead of representing the danger to which others are exposed, I will make the case my own. It behooves me to tremble at the word of the Lord as much as others, and as I am a sinner and therefore naturally subject to the penalty of the law and liable to be misled by the deceitfulness of my heart to cherish false hopes, I will endeavor to realize to myself the feelings which I shall experience if it should be my unhappy lot to die out of the favor of God. It would seem that the first moment after death must be one of unparalleled misery. My first reflection would be this: I am lost forever. All hope of happiness, of relief, is gone from my miserable soul. The blackness of darkness is round me, about me, all about me. No ray of light dawns on my wretched soul. Despair, terrible despair, has now seized upon me and must blacken every prospect to all eternity. While in the world I could contrive to turn away my thoughts from the disagreeable subject, but now my misery, like a heavy burden, presses on me and is ever present, go where I will, do what I will. While in the body and engaged in secular pursuits, I entertained a secret hope that there might be some mistake respecting the extreme misery of the damned, or that there might possibly be some way of escape not revealed. But now all these idle notions have fled like a dream when one awakes. I find hell to be no fable, but a dreadful reality. I find that the preachers, so far from exaggerating the misery of the lost, had no adequate conception of the wretchedness of a soul cast off from God forever and doomed to dwell in everlasting burnings. Oh, horrible, horrible! I am then undone, forever undone. In all former distresses, I could cry for mercy, but now I have passed beyond the reach of mercy. For the sake of momentary enjoyments and the worthless riches and honors, I have bartered away my soul. Accursed folly, what benefit can I now derive from those earthly pleasures and possessions? They only serve as fuel to the flames which now consume me. Oh, for one drop of water to cool my tongue, but for this I beg in vain. The time for prayer and for mercy has gone by, and my soul is lost, lost, lost. And through eternity it must expect no deliverance, no relief, nor ever even the slightest mitigation of my misery. Woe, woe, woe is me. And yet, don't fear hell. Fear God. When Jesus said this, he did not say, fear hell. He said, fear him.
And then he said, I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. And then he says, are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not. You are more valuable than many sparrows. You see how close fear of God dispels all other fears. No fear of God brings your worst fears. But this is all not to be a Christian's fear. I will tell you why. John Bunyan helped me on this. He asks a series of questions about fear, asking, believer, do you fear the fires of hell? Do you fear the lack of assurance? Do you fear that you are not good enough? Does this fear of God cause a callousness in your heart? Does this fear of God cause a coldness? Does this fear of God cause you to lack in prayer? Does this fear of God cause you to blaspheme and become bitter? Does this fear of God drive you away from him? And then he says this, how much of God do you think are in these fears? How much of his spirit and the grace of his word? Just this, none at all. For it cannot be that these things can be the true and natural effects of the workings of the Spirit of God. No, not as a spirit of bondage. These are not God's doings. Dost thou not see the very paw of the devil in them? I love it. Here's the point. The point is simple. Fear that does not take you to God, draw you near, is a fear that drives you away. Any fear that drives you away from God is not the kind of fear a Christian should have. So I close tonight on this. We've looked at the absence of fear, the abject fear of God as just, and finally, and just shortly, adoring fear. The next session will make much more of this, but for this closure, I want to end back in Romans. Look at Romans with me one more time, Romans chapter 3, and what we find here is this adoring fear as God is just. And look at it with me. Oh, this is marvelous. Romans 3, 18, there is no fear of God before their eyes. We looked at that. And he points out, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes the knowledge of sin. So far, he's saying, an unbeliever, one who is trying to in some way earn their way before God, earn their acceptance, simply cannot. Now watch what he says next. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. Although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. Verse 22, the righteousness, this is the justice of God. The just God. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift. Through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness or justice, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show God's justice or his righteousness at the present time, so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Beloved and friends, you see, the key here is that justice had to be satisfied. And the Christian does not fear the wrath of God, for that wrath was satisfied on Christ crucified. And so the Christian now understands that the reason that Christ was crucified is because God is a God of justice. But there's a marvelous irony and twist to this thought, and that is this, that we now fear God, I dare say, even more. Not because we fear the wrath of the punishment of our sin, for that has been taken away on the cross. But now we fear a God who would love us so much that he would satisfy the justice that burns by doing it on another, his own son. And we have the added fear of God as just by knowing that if our sin has been punished on Christ, God is just. A just God will never punish the same crime twice. And therefore, we Christians have a greater fear of God because he's just, because we know not only did Christ suffer the justice we deserved, but now we will never suffer that justice because God's justice demands that it be punished only once. Now we have reason to fear. But that's for the next session as we look at the grace of God. Stay tuned and join us next time. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time with this church that I love. Thank you for the opportunity to look into these serious and weighty matters. I know that this is a deep and difficult subject, a heavy one. And I do ask that you would do what I cannot do, and that is to bring to each heart exactly the power of this in exactly the right way, so that it would have the greatest fruit to your glory and their good. I thank you for them. I ask your blessing upon them. May all of us learn to fear the Lord, for he is not only holy, but he is just. Amen.